Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Matt Swanson, creator of Boring Rails. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey Jason, good to be back.
Good to have you back. For those of the listeners who aren't familiar with you, can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Matt. I've been writing a blog for the past couple years called Boring Rails, where I talk about the sort of boring vanilla Rails stack and how to use that to be super productive in writing web apps.
So today we're going to talk about something that might sound boring as a topic, but it's actually super interesting, I think. And the topic is estimation and story points and all that kind of stuff. And to kind of tee this up, here's why I think this is a really interesting topic. So sometimes there are like things in life that are boring, but if they help you get to your goals, they become suddenly very interesting. And this is one of those things, like a lot of people have probably shared my experience where you work on a team and every sprint you get assigned a certain amount of work and you never even come close to finishing it inside the sprint. And some of it spills over to the next sprint or whatever. And then in the next sprint planning meeting, you get assigned a bunch of stuff and yet again, it's too much stuff and it's just not realistic at all. And you don't get it all done. It probably sounds like a familiar story to a lot of people listening. And so I'm interested in the ideas of estimation and related topics because it's just so painful to have that experience over and over, that if you know how to fix it, that's just so useful to be able to do that. What about you, Matt? Have you had that experience where you just,
Yeah, so I've definitely experienced the whole spectrum of estimation and story points. And just for some context, my day job, I work at a consulting agency. So we are doing all kinds of different projects. So I've worked on probably 20 different projects over my career with various teams running various processes, but all some kind of flavor of you know, agile or these types of processes. So yeah, I've done pretty much everything you can throw at me in terms of story points, and I've played every game. I've tried every method. I've had teams where we did no story pointing, no estimates. I've had teams where we did capital N, capital E, like no estimates, like the hashtag, which is an interesting sort of interesting tangent around how those kind of movements rise up in opposition to, you know, standard agile practices. And I've done, you know, everything in the middle. I've had good experiences and bad experiences. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I would kind of separate this thing into two ideas maybe. So, okay. When teams fail at meeting their sprints, it's a failure of planning as opposed to a failure of execution, I would say. And I think there's kind of two reasons for that failure of planning. And one is a reason of discipline, and another is a reason of maybe you would call it logic or like lack of estimation skills or something like that. I'll address the discipline thing first. I'm laughing because this experience I've had over and over is just so funny how consistent it is and how like predictable human nature is. So I would get together with our team. We would have our sprint planning meeting or whatever, and the project manager would pick out a certain number of stories and we would tee it up, and it would be, let's say, 47 story points for the team. Mm-hmm. And one of the like principles in our Agile practice was that each team member would commit to their scope of work. And so we would go around to each individual person and say, how's this look? Does it look good? And each person would say, yeah, this looks good. Yeah, it looks good to me. Looks good to me too. And then it would come around to me and I would be like, okay, 47 story points. Last sprint, we did 21. The sprint before that, we did 17. Sprint before that, we did 19. And so this time we're doing 47. Like, how do you figure that's going to work? And then we would like, reluctantly, they would like cut down the scope to something that matched our historical velocity. But then the very next sprint, the same thing would happen again, and they would tee up way too much stuff. So there needs to be like somebody present who can be that voice of pessimism, and realisticness to everybody else. Because for whatever reason, there's like a natural human nature tendency to be optimistic and to have an attitude of we can do it and stuff like that. But that's just not reality. You have to look at your historical velocity and base your future planning on that.
Yeah, there's like a whole bunch of, you know, psychological effects and just interesting quirks about like work, I think, that are also wrapped up in that, right? Like nobody's gonna ever say like, yes, I would like to do the bare minimum, or like I'm fine, like not excelling, right? This is not really like, you know, the culture that we have, you know, in this country about work, right? It's like you always need to be advancing, you always need to be doing better. So it's kind of interesting. And when you put a number on a, you know, development team's output in terms of story points, it's like, yeah, like don't like, wouldn't you kind of expect that the number would at least slowly go up, like as we're becoming more familiar with the system or people are getting more experienced? I don't think that's really ever been that true in my experience, that like we've been drastically better. Certainly you do, you know, at the beginning of a project, you're still getting up to speed on things. And
yeah, that's interesting. Have you encountered people having the expectation that velocity would increase over time? Because I haven't really encountered that.
I would say I've worked in one particular project where it wasn't so much that there was the expectation that it would go up, but it was the expectation that if you were you needed to do at least the number of points and hopefully more. And if you did more, then, you know, that means you probably undercommitted. So it basically created this like, you know, ratcheting up of what we were like expected to be taking on. This whole thing like is kind of, it's kind of silly to me too, because like if you set targets based on the numbers, then like intentionally or subconsciously or something, like developers just start kind of inflating the individual items. So then it's like, yeah, we need to do 20 points this week, not 18 points like last week. It's like, oh, okay, well, I'll just call this thing that I thought was 2 points, 3 points, and now we're still doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, if it's like you have a factory with 10 machines, and each machine can produce X number of widgets per day or whatever, you of course wouldn't expect that over time those machines could produce more widgets. Obviously the difference is that humans are capable of learning and improving. But I think of the sprint planning thing more analogous to machines. Like we have 10 developers, on average, each developer is capable of doing X number of stories per week. And I don't really expect that number to go up over time. But that's really interesting. I hadn't even like thought about that before, because I've never come across anybody who expected things to go faster and faster.
Yeah. It's interesting too. Like, I think your machine analogy is interesting, but I would say that actually, even in your machine scenario, like you kind of would expect the production of the facility like as a whole to go up, right? Like over time, we would notice inefficiencies and optimize the process so that, you know, we could have, you know, 30% more things. But then at the same time, there's also like, well, the machines will break down and we'll have downtime.
Yeah, I was going to say there's an argument to be made that the efficiency would go down over time. And in fact, I think an organization's efficiency always does go down over time, even though the overall absolute amount of output increases, because you get the like diseconomy of scale as you add more and more people to the organization, you just can't be as efficient as you were when you only had a small number of people.
Yeah. I read something recently that was kind of interesting. It was basically about the origin of scientific management, which is kind of this whole, the root of all these like productivity measures and sort of the bringing of numbers and metrics into the business world, which is definitely like at the root of Agile and how, at least in practice, a lot of the Agile practices turned from, you know, what was in the Agile manifesto to a like scientifically managed process that has a lot of numbers and supposed rigor, and you know, you can manage it like a factory, like it's like a system control thing. And it was interesting when you go back to the origins of like scientific management, it was really a way to sort of you know, screw over the individual workers by saying, hey, we'll pay you for your output instead of paying you, you know, for your time. And look, you can, if you work really hard, you can make more than you were making. But then that gets, you know, it's like, yes, you know, if you normally could, you know, let's try to make a code example. If you normally could finish, you know, two stories in a week, and you get paid, you know, a salary, and we say, oh, we'll pay you per story that you can finish. But you know, if you do three stories in a week, you'll be making more than you were, you know, that's a good deal for you. But in reality, then at some point the cost per story, you know, goes down, and suddenly you're end up doing double the work for the same pay. That's not really how it works in software, but that's kind of how the origins of this worked. It was like people loading some material into like a smelter or something. And eventually you it's like, yeah, you can make more money if you are sprinting, for 8 hours a day, like, carrying loads with no break. And like, yeah, you'll be making more money than you would like working normally. Like, this should be a good deal. And I don't know, it gets into more of a critique of, the whole economic system, and I'll save that for later. I'm ill-equipped and underprepared for that.
Yeah, it sounds like in theory there's a way that could be fair, but I can imagine ways that in practice it would go in an unfair way. Yeah, so to go back to what I was saying about discipline and the skill of estimation, I guess we kind of touched on the discipline thing, but the estimation skill thing, I read this really good book that I'm looking back on my shelf. It's Software Estimation by Steve McConnell. And he said, like, don't try to estimate things. Just keep track of your historical velocity. Like, yep. how many features can I build in a certain amount of time? And then when you want to build a new project, you count the number of features in the project and multiply that by how long it takes you on average to build a feature. And that is your answer. And it sounds too simplistic to actually work, but surprisingly, it works a lot better than the normal strategy, which the book says the conventional estimation strategy is to go with your gut and multiply by three, which... Yeah. Yeah, it gives you a really inaccurate number. Whereas if you count instead of estimate, it works out a lot better.
Yeah, I think I've had good experiences with that style of, you know, counting before. And I think you alluded to this a little bit in your Twitter discussion about this topic of just like assuming that everything is like one point or like all stories are the same size. That kind of helps, I think, level out some of the extremes. And then at that point, like, if everything takes about, you know, a day or two to do, and after writing 500 stories, you tend to write them about the same size because, you know, like, you sort of have it's maybe a slow feedback loop, but, you know, as the person writing stories, you do sort of get some feedback on, like, this was too big and I had lots of questions and this took forever. Like, I'll break it down smaller next time.
So, yeah. And
yeah,
I want to,
it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I want to elaborate on that just a little bit, because like, I think the whole story points thing is actually not very helpful, because like, It's an arbitrary judgment. Is this story 1 point or 2, 4, 8, whatever? Different developers will have a different idea of how many points something should get. And then there's like these time wasting discussions. I'm like, really? You think that's an 8? That's definitely only a 4, and like blah, blah, blah. And it works out so much better in my experience when you just give each story 1 point and you kind of take care to break your stories down as small as they can be, which independent of anything to do with estimation is a good idea anyway, because it has all these benefits, including the ability to deploy frequently. It's easier to review a PR on something small than something big, all this stuff. So it's a good idea anyway. But if you make sure your stories are pretty small, then they're going to be roughly the same size. And even if they're not, like even if your stories vary by a factor of 4 or something like that, like some of your stories take half a day, some of them take 2 days, on average, they're all the same. And so, you know, you talked, Matt, about like if you finish all your stories in a sprint, then that's good. And if you don't, then that's bad. And if you did, that means you undercommitted. And obviously, that's like not the right way to look at it, I don't think. Because what happens in reality is you take the average and you put a certain number of story points into a sprint based on your historical average. And sometimes you're going to overestimate. Sometimes you're going to underestimate. Very rarely will you be exactly right. But I think you know if you're doing good if some of the time you're over and some of the time you're under. But over the course of a year, it all evens out. And you were never, you're never right one single time. Never ever are you correct on a single sprint. But for the entire year, you're exactly right. And that's the only thing that matters.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, and you raised the point that, like, you know, maybe you're off by, you know, a factor of 4 or something. And I've seen kind of 2 failure modes. And when I say a failure mode, I mean, like, the project went way over budget or schedule. And sort of the first level analysis is like, it was a bad estimate. And I think there's 2 different and interesting failure modes. One is that you just have this sort of slow over time, like degradation of what your team can output. And I think this is one that most people are probably familiar with. And I think you alluded to earlier in the episode around you just kind of slow down as you add more complexity. Things get more complicated. You've knocked off all the easy features. You have a bigger system that has more moving pieces. You maybe have you know, technical debt that needs to get paid down or is inhibiting you. And so it's not so much that like you're particularly bad at estimating. It was just, well, when we embarked on this project, we assumed we would be, and even if you measured for like the first 6 weeks of the project, said this is, you know, we can do 20 stories, you know, a sprint or whatever. If you're not careful, like your team just slowly like degrades as your code base gets, you know, hairier and hairier to work with. So then it kind of slowly sinks, and then suddenly you look 6 months out and it's like we're only doing 10 stories a week, and like nothing has changed. We weren't necessarily like bad at knowing the size of the work. It's just like things slow down. So that's one failure mode. I think that's the one that most people are probably familiar with. And I think there's lots of literature about, you know, how do you, you know, it's kind of like maintenance and upkeep, right? How do you reserve some capacity to make sure that we're cleaning up messes and, you know, writing tests and refactoring and all this.
Why do you call that a failure mode? Because like, okay, there's maybe 2 ways that could go. One way is like, let's say the code is really good. But at the beginning of a project, it's just natural that things are going to be easy because there's low hanging fruit. You're just building like these CRUD interfaces and there's not that much to connect with. And so it's pretty quick and easy. And then as things get more complex, even what seems to an outsider like something that should be a 5-minute change really might take a few hours, because every time you change anything, there's all these other things that it needs to connect with, even if the project's code is high quality. So you're going to have a slowdown for that reason. And the other way things could go, and the way things usually do go, is the code is not in that great of a shape, And so over time, your ability to produce output goes down and down just because the code gets more and more difficult to work with. I suspect that you're mainly referring to that latter case when you call it a failure mode. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. What I mean is that a project could potentially fail or be viewed as like a failure because, you know, you've drastically missed your deadline. And even you'd say, well, we did estimates, we spent time up front, and we even measured how we were doing for the first 6 weeks. It's not like we said at the start of the project that, you know, this is the estimate for when we're going to get done, like 2 years later or something, which is sort of a fool's errand. But you know, if you say let's measure our team's progress for 6 weeks, and then sort of, like you're sort of saying, start like multiplying that by how many things are left to do to get an estimate. I think that's one way that I've seen that fail, is that we assume sort of constant output, and then that doesn't end up being the case.
Yeah. Yeah. I see what you mean. Okay.
So the other way that I actually see projects like fail, and these are maybe somewhat hyperbolic, like the project didn't maybe like completely fail, but like in the world of consulting, like if a project is going to overrun its cost by, you know, double or take 3 years when it was planned to take, you know, 1 year, like that's in some regards considered a failure. The other failure mode is just when you have one of these like tail risk things that hits and really throws the entire project for a loop. And so that's something where I don't know that the Agile community or people doing story pointing and estimating really appreciate those types of risks. So those are things that I'm thinking, like, hey, we assumed that we could use this library to do charting, and then then it was determined that like the project can't have any open source because of a licensing issue, right? And suddenly, like, you know, what you had planned to be a certain size is like ballooned because you have to build your own charting library. Or we assumed that this API that this other team is building would be done in September, so we'll have plenty of time to get it ready for the, you know, December release. And then, you know, that vendor goes bankrupt and has to like completely start over, and everything gets thrown out of the loop. So there is an interesting phenomenon where I think you're talking about how over time all the variations sort of level out, you can get some consistency. And I think that is largely true for the majority of projects the majority of the time. And you can go almost, you know, a whole career without actually hitting one of these like huge blowups. But it doesn't mean that you were ever like really safe from it, nor were you particularly insulated by, you know, your method of saying, well, we're estimating this, or we have this process. So I don't know, that's something that interests me a little bit, that a lot of these tools and processes sort of give a false sense of certainty in terms of what we can deliver, or on a project level, what it will cost, when it'll be done. It's almost like the more advanced the estimation and story pointing and forecasting and estimating, the more advanced it is, like the surer it seems, but actually the more likely it is to potentially blow up. Now, maybe it never blows up. And that's kind of the risk. That's, you know, we were talking on Twitter about Nassim Taleb, and he has this idea of like the turkey problem, right? So imagine you're the presidential turkey, right? Every day is great. You've got these people that bring you food, that take care of you. You're on this free range organic farm, and you say, well, yesterday was really good. You know, what do I predict tomorrow is going to be? Really good, you know. And that happens for, you know, 5 years, and then suddenly it's Thanksgiving Day, and you either get you get pardoned, or you go to slaughter, and it didn't matter that you had, you know, a run of 500 days where, you know, you didn't get cooked for dinner, right?
So yeah,
there's definitely risks where you could have a project that we had 50 sprints all in a row that all did between 10 and 12 story points. Like we should be able to predict out, you know, with great certainty, and we can use statistics and confidence intervals, and we can use Monte Carlo forecasts to tell you that with, you know, 89.768% confidence we'll be able to ship this feature by, you know, March 1st. And then you hit one of these tail risks and everything blows up.
That's the turkey problem or whatever. I heard another version of that, the same thing expressed a different way. There's this guy who falls from the roof of a skyscraper, and on the way down, somebody's looking out an open window and they see him and they're like, "Oh, hey, how's it going out there?" And he's like, "Ah, so far, so good."
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, you have to put that kind of stuff in context. Like, obviously, it is possible for, to go back to the turkey, things are great every day, and then all of a sudden there's some calamity that you didn't predict because you're basing everything off of what happened before. But it's also true, like the yesterday's weather thing. Like, tomorrow's weather will probably be pretty similar to yesterday's weather. If it was snowing yesterday, it's probably not going to be 90 degrees outside tomorrow. But, you know, I guess the analogy to like the turkey problem thing would be those unforeseen difficulties. Like, you're working on a project, and that example you gave, you suddenly discover that you can't use any open source projects.
Right.
That would be, obviously, there's just some things that are going to be outside your control sometimes.
Yeah. And the thing, you know, I don't bring this up to say that like we should, you know, never plan ahead because, you know, who knows what happens, you know, there's a fire in your office building tomorrow and, you know, the database gets melted, you know, literally. It's not to say that you should always be preparing for that and never wanting to commit to anything, but you really have to take into account too, like the size of the potential, like, the fallout from the risk, right? So yeah, there's a low chance that, you know, we could not have to, you know, use this open source project or whatever. Like, okay, well, does that, like, what is the fallout from that? Does that cancel the whole project? Does that like fire everyone at the company? Is that, oh, well, we have to cut other features, or yeah, we're gonna have to have an uncomfortable conversation with a customer, but ultimately, like, everyone understands that, you know, that happened. You know, maybe we get fired, maybe not, but I don't know. I think that's something that always is in the back of my mind whenever I hear people discussing, you know, the best ways to do estimating and forecasting and all that is how much are we giving a false sense of confidence? And then just hoping that we aren't, you know, the one in 20 projects that has some huge blow up, you know, risk happen. And how long can you, you know, pick up pennies in front of the proverbial steamroller before you accidentally like trip and fall and get crushed to death?
You know, I want to address something that you said earlier because I disagreed with it. And I think what you said was like, to the extent to which you have these like methodologies that give you these high level of confidence, if you have the more certainty that gives you, the higher the risk of failure is, or something like that. Is that what you said, or am I like misunderstanding that?
It's that usually when you have complex processes for like making a prediction, they tend to be more fragile. So a lot of times, like you can see this in like prediction models, where if you have a prediction model with like three variables, in some ways that's preferable to one that has like 300 variables. Because if one has 300 variables, you maybe don't understand all the interconnections, and there's the potential that like one small thing changes that has this huge ripple effect. So I would say in the context of software estimates, like my firm has we've done a lot of stuff around like using Monte Carlo forecasts to like do a whole project level forecast, right? To say at the start of a project, we think this is going to be, you know, about this size. And the way that works is you run a Monte Carlo simulation, you estimate what you think the work is. And then that can give you confidence intervals of like, well, you know, because customers need to know these things. They need to know will we be done, you know, at the end of the year with this project. And we can say, maybe, but like 50% of the time you're not going to be done. Like, is that a problem? And then we can start to have conversations about adjusting the scope or adjusting the team size or other things like that. But the problem is that if you don't frame these things correctly, you could say, oh, well, this model said, you know, I tweaked this number and said that we'll have, 2.1 developers or something, or you can play with the parameters. And then since it's just math and it's not being put into the context of like the real world project, you have this thing where you'd say like, yeah, with 90% certainty, I can say that this project will be done by like September the 12th. And it's like, wow, that's great. Like, that's really appealing to someone in the business side of things who wants to have some kind of certainty. But it's not really, we don't really actually have enough like rigor and precision to say that necessarily. So that's where I was going with that point, is that sometimes the more specific you can be, the more perceived certainty there is. Like, if I were to tell you, you know, here's a number with 5 decimal points, even though it may or may not be more accurate than, you know, just an integer or something, like, it feels like it's more like correct or
totally.
There's more weight behind it.
Yeah, it's funny how that is. I would say that this stuff is like necessary but not sufficient, or helpful but not sufficient. Like, yeah. If you have a methodology that allows you to more or less accurately size your sprints and you're correct on average over and over, then that's super helpful, obviously. That's much better than being wrong every single time. But that's not all there is to the picture, and you still have to be smart about your project planning in general. Like,
yeah.
I've worked on projects where they have they had a deadline that's relatively far in the future, and they had some parts of the project that were like very straightforward, mundane work, just CRUD interfaces and stuff like that. And then other parts of the project that were very complex and risky, and they saved the complex, risky stuff for near the end of the project. And that's a case where it's not going to matter how good your estimation is from sprint to sprint if you didn't plan the entire project in a smart way.
Yep. It's really interesting too. Like, you know, when you talk about Agile and sort of the numbers and that sort of thing, like, you could say, oh, the project is 80% done. We've got 80% of the stories completed, and we have 20 stories left, and we do 10 a week. Like, you should expect it to be in 2 weeks. And yeah, like you said, if you did something like you're talking about where you backload everything, it's not gonna be the case. And then suddenly something like a system that you thought was in control, that you had your head around because everything was, you know, following nicely, your burn down chart and your numbers were looking good, is suddenly like a hair on fire situation.
Maybe something we could talk about before we close things out is, in order to be successful with all this stuff, you need to have high quality stories. And what I mean by that is, you can't have stories that are really vague. You can't have stories that say things like complete products section, because that's just not even, it's too vague to like, how do you know when you're done with that? You have to have stories that are small and crisp and have a very clear definition of done. And that's for a few reasons. One is because, obviously, like, if you have stories that are so vague that a developer starts to work on one and they read the description and they don't even know what to do based on the description, then that's going to cause time waste inside of your sprint, because then, of course, the developer has to go to the PM or whoever and say, hey, this story is not something that I can actually work on. Can you help me understand what this was really supposed to be? And, you know, sometimes the answer is like, oh, we don't even really actually know what this is supposed to be because we didn't take the time to plan it. And so then you have to go back and do the whole process of wireframes and like thinking through how things are going to work. And you're doing that during the sprint. That's going to cause all kinds of problems with your estimation, obviously. And so all that stuff has to happen upstream in order for anything we've talked about so far to be viable.
Yeah, I think that's really important. There's definitely a lot of assumptions that are maybe understated around some of these things. Like, we talked earlier in the episode around, like, yeah, I think both you and I favor like single size per story, you know, versus story pointing, you know, as a general rule of thumb, if you have to do this practice. Now there's, like you said, there are assumptions to that. Like we assume that all stories actually are the same size and they are specified to a reasonable level of detail, and that, you know, we will plan ahead. And I think that's where people sometimes run into issues with these practices too, is that someone will hear that and say, yep, I heard on this podcast or read a blog post or something that said that like story points are dumb. We should just make everything like a one and just move on with our lives. And that may be true, but it's not the full story. We have to like have that caveat of like, yes, if you work to make all your stories roughly the same size over time and you average it out and they're very clear so that you know when you're done, then this can work. But I think we would both agree that if, you know, if you've got someone managing the product who is not writing small stories that are concretely defined and crisp, as you said, I like that word. If you don't have that, and then you just try to like lead a rebellion that says like all stories are one, like it's not going to work.
Right. Yeah. All those parts have to be there in order for it to work. So dear listener, I hope this episode has been educational for you. Last question for you, Matt, is where can people go to find you online?
Yeah, the best place to find me online these days is on Twitter. My Twitter account is _Swanson.
Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.